Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
Has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two.
Gilmore.
Oh, big stop.
Oh,
brother.
Lead Toledo artist. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead.
Hello, and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA podcast. I am Jason Mann, and with me is my partner, Rich Craich. Rich, good to be back with you.
Yes, yeah, no uniforms today.
No uniform. We're right. Past the uniforms. We've gotten through our best and worst uniforms. Hope everybody enjoyed those shows. Appreciate any. We've gotten some nice feedback on those, but any more feedback that we get, definitely appreciate that. Or of course,
we haven't had enough people tell us we're wrong yet, and that kind of disturbs me. I want you to tell us how we are wrong and defend your crappy jersey or your good jersey that you think.
We love to hear well reasoned arguments, not ones that call us nasty names, but you know.
No, I like those too.
Well,
no,
okay, that's fair. That's fair. So. Today we are going to tackle a very big subject, I guess you could say, one of, if not the greatest player in NBA history, Wilt Chamberlain. And, you know, you could spend hours and hours talking about Wilt Chamberlain. We've decided to just kind of focus a little bit on the most impressive or interesting statistics that he produced in his career. I mean, he's a guy just... The numbers are just amazing. Obviously, the 100-point game, the first in rebounds and points, 50 point per game average, 55 rebounds in a game, so on and so forth. I mean, the numbers are that they're better than a video game. I mean, basically, he broke basketball for a number of years and just put up numbers that are, you know, have never been seen before or since. And so, we're going to talk about that, and to help us with that is definitely an expert in the field. He is the man behind the Wilt Chamberlain Archive, the great YouTube channel and Twitter account that talks, of course, focuses on Wilt Chamberlain, but also shares a lot of great videos and information about basketball history. Dan, welcome to the program.
Oh, good, good. Good to be here.
Yeah. So, before we kind of get into just the numbers that we're going to talk about, tell us a little bit about the Wilt Chamberlain Archive.
Well, it was just a YouTube channel that I started to basically to put videos up of that I had collected of Wilt Chamberlain and to sort of make highlights or videos to highlight certain parts of his game that I wanted to see. Basically videos that weren't there because if you looked at his statistics, they're so amazing and you want to try to figure out, okay, you know, who was he as a player and how did he look on the floor? There wasn't a lot out there. So I just basically wanted to put videos up that I wanted to see. And it looks like other people enjoy watching them too. So that's good.
Yeah, we've really enjoyed it. What in particular got you interested in Wilt or fascinates you about Wilt? I mean, there's so much, obviously, but is there anything that really stands out?
Well, the first thing that stands out is the numbers. I mean, when I was getting into basketball as LeBron James was coming into the scene, everybody talked about how dominant his numbers were and things like that. And you just browse the history of the game a little bit. And there are big names that stand out, like Michael Jordan, obviously. And, but when you look at just the numbers, Wilt is sort of, you know, in his own little category. And, that's basically it. That pulls you in. And from there, you know, it's just, you try to explore as much as possible to understand how he did those numbers.
Yeah, I remember one of my first memories of Basketball Reference, is a great site that we obviously use on every single podcast that we do, is when you go to Wilt Chamberlain's page, it's just like, you forget that the Bold is like league leader, because you just only see Bold when you go to his page. Like there's like a 5-year period, you know, between obviously his rookie year and probably about, you know, the tail end of the Philadelphia years, where just everything is Bold. Like almost everything except for free throw percentage or whatever is just like in this unbelievable Bold, and you're just like, oh my God, like this guy is just, it's, as Jason said a little bit earlier, that's a guy that's breaking basketball when you're as dominant and as much of a league leader in terms of statistics as he was. And then when you read about Wilt and you read the stuff about him, about people talking about playing with him, playing against him, all that sort of stuff, you just look at a guy who's just so unbelievable to look at his career and the scope of his career, of just what he was able to do on the basketball court and what he was able to accumulate stat-wise. I mean, there's some, obviously, criticisms of his ability to win and the free throw shooting and this other stuff like that. I mean, we're not going to do much of that in this podcast, I don't believe, but we're really going to just look on the bright side, and a lot of the bright is just, it's unbelievable how much depth there is to his numbers as well. And that's what we're going to do a little bit as well, is when you really look at it and look at, like, man, like the things that he led the league in and how much he led the league in and the things just all time and the stuff he was able to do. It's just, he's just an unbelievable player. More than anyone, I think, in the NBA, statistics-wise, he is just so much the most fascinating one in my mind.
Yeah, and just taking a look at just sort of the overall picture before we get into things more in depth. He was a 4-time MVP, 7-time All-NBA first team. And, you know, mind you, he is competing, of course, against Bill Russell almost his entire career, and then later Kareem. And so, there are only 2 All-NBA teams. So the fact that he was finishing ahead of Russell and Kareem during these years, very impressive. 5th all-time in points. He blew away the points record, which we'll talk about a little bit later, just how far ahead he was at his peak. 2nd all-time in points per game, just a very, very tiny bit behind Michael Jordan. 1st in rebounds and rebounds per game by miles. Only player to lead the league in points, rebounds, and assists in different seasons. Led the league in points and in rebounds many times, assists only 1 time. Had most double-doubles. And he played an average of 45.8 minutes per game, which is just, you know, amazing, especially later in his career when he slowed down, still playing, you know, at an amazing amount. He had 100.
James Harden would be very upset about that if he had to play 45 minutes a game. James Harden doesn't want to play 38. So.
There you go. And he had 128 NBA records when he retired. He still has, I believe, 71 records. So that's pretty amazing. And Rich, there, you pointed out some of the advanced stats as well that you just basic ones that blow you away.
Yeah, for sure. Four of the top 10 single season win share seasons of all time. That's in 1964, 1962, 1967, and 1966 in that order. He also has the 2nd highest ever single season win share, and that's in the 1963-64 season as well. He's 3rd highest win shares per 48 ever. That's his 1964 season. And then he also has 3 of the top 10 single season PR records, including 1st and 2nd highest ever, which is 63 and 62. So you look at advanced stuff, really loves him. And like you said, the raw numbers, everybody kind of knows about those, the points, the rebounds, that sort of stuff, even the assists that we'll get to here in a little bit. But yeah, in terms of the advanced stuff, they love him as well.
All right. So, you know, kind of starting out with, some of the single game statistics, Dan, is there anything that really stands out to you first? I mean, we can start with the obvious one, or whatever you think, or maybe something that you've discovered in your research that would blow our listeners away. Either way, is there something that stands out to you?
Just for single game?
Yeah.
Well, one of them that is unofficial. As far as block shots, he has the NBA record for most points in the triple-double, officially. And I think he had 53 points in that game. But in 1962, the season where he averaged 50 a game in the regular season, he had a playoff game where, at the time, I think he broke like 6 records in just that one game. I don't know what those records were. It wasn't specified in the news archive that I was reading. But his stat line in that game in the playoffs It was a closing game against the Syracuse Nationals, and he had 56 points, 35 rebounds, and 12 block shots. And that's a playoff
good
game.
Good day at the office.
Yeah. So I think that's the most points in a triple-double by any player ever, although it's unofficial because of the block shots is not an official statistic from that time. But it was tallied or counted by the journalists who watched the game. So that would be one of them. And that was in the playoffs. So that was the then playoff record for points as well.
Mm-hmm. And
one that I really love, sorry, not to interrupt, but 61-62 season, which we're going to talk about at length here in a little bit, but one of my favorite ones of doing a little bit of research for him, and I just thought of this when we were talking about single games, is in the All-Star game that year. He dropped 42 points, 24 rebounds, and shot 73% from the field. So I was just like that it's like an All-Star game where it's like, all right, you can take the day off, Will. Okay, I'll just drop 42 and 24. You know, no big deal. Like, it's just like, who gets 42 points in an All-Star game? Like, come on, man. What are you doing? But it's, that's Wilt.
Yeah, and, you know, not to mention, I mean, of course he has the 100-point game, which I've always thought a little bit, I mean, obviously it's 100 points and it's incredibly impressive, but he, you know, the way that that was produced by his team basically fouling the Knicks to get more possessions so Wilt would get more chances to score was sort of like a little bit of subverting the game in a way just to get a record. Whereas, you know, during that season, during that his career, he's also had 78, 73 twice, 72, and 70 is six of the top 10 scoring games ever. I think that's a little bit more impressive than just the 100-point game, although obviously that's staggering in its own way as well.
Yeah, the rest of NBA history combined has four 70-point performances. He has six.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And of course, rebounding as well. I mean, he has the record of 55 rebounds per game, which happened in 1960 against the Celtics. In fact, he has 15 games with 40 plus rebounds, which has happened 29 times. Russell's had 11 of those times. Only three times has it been a different player other than Russell and Chamberlain. Obviously, pace is a big factor in that because the game in those days was played at a much faster pace and there were more chances, more missed shots because guys didn't shoot as well. So there are more chances for a rebound, but still, those numbers are obviously incredible. Rich, is there another one for you?
Yeah, well, I think you guys brought up the 70-point games, which I think are super impressive. But I actually like the 60-point games even a little bit more because he's got 32 60-point-plus games. And then what's just fascinating is Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant are tied for second with five each. It's just like it's not even like – no one's even close. 32 to 5. And, like, that's not even – it's just – to me, that's the most unbelievable. It's staggering, the difference between him and basically just anybody else throughout history. And I think one of the things that you mentioned about the pace and that sort of stuff, which is obviously something that we talk about a lot, is that context matters in cases like this. But I think in a sense as well, Will can only play in the era that he plays in. And that's what we've always done on this podcast as well, is not necessarily try to grade eras on an even playing field all the time of understanding that, hey, Wilt is in this era and that, you know, he is what it is. We'll talk about it here in a little bit. But, I mean, he, above his peers even, stood out tremendously. So it's not just some guy who was just bum sling and like in any other, you know, or his team had some funky thing that made him good or whatever. It wasn't really that. It was just he was so much better than everybody else in his era in terms of compiling these stats that's what really makes him stand out in some sense. But I think it is important to mention that context.
Sure.
And the pace as well.
Sure. Dan, anything, another one for you?
Well, just to add to the 60-point performances, again, all other players in NBA history, if you combine everyone except Wilt, they also they combine for 32 60-point performances. So he alone has tied the rest of NBA history with 60-point performances.
Yeah, and he had 118 50-point games. Jordan is second with 31. 271 40-point games. Jordan is second with 173. And Wilt played in 1,045 games. So he almost 26% of his games were 40 points or better.
And he, as far as if you track how his coaches wanted him to play the game and how he cooperated and tried to play the game a certain way, he really only tried to score as much as he could for about seven seasons.
Yeah,
the other seasons he was throttling back and, yeah, and looking to dominate the game in other ways. So that makes that even more impressive, I think.
And he is second all time in triple doubles in a season. He had 31 triple doubles in 67, 68. And that was during the time in which, you know, he was dialing back and scoring and was concentrating more on assists and, you know, being more balanced and focusing more on defense as well. That was the year after they had won the championship and were still really good, although they lost to the Celtics that year in the playoffs. I think Billy Cunningham was hurt in that series. Rich, are there any other ones that stand out to you?
In terms of single games, not really. There's some other stuff. Yeah, nothing single game wise.
Yeah.
No.
Two more that really stand out for me. There were in February 2nd, 1969, he had the only 20-20-20 game ever recorded. 22 points, 25 rebounds, 21 assists. And then five times he had 40 plus point and 40 plus rebound games. So, Dan, are there any other single games that stand out to you?
Well, I think he had, again, this is unofficial, with games where block shot data was recorded by someone. He has three quadruple doubles, and they are also all in the playoffs. I think one of them is against Bill Russell in 1967, where he had 24 points, 32 rebounds, 13 assists, and 12 block shots. And the other one is against Nate Thurmond, that same playoff run, the same championship run, where he had 10 blocks, 10 points, 38 rebounds, and 10 assists. And he did it again a few seasons later while he was on the Lakers against the Phoenix Suns, where he had 12 points, 26 rebounds, 11 assists, and 12 blocks. So, you know, quadruple doubles, you know, are not easy to come by, we know. And these are all unofficial. The NBA doesn't officially recognize block shots from that time period, but it gives some sort of insight into how dominant he was with defense as well, not just offense.
And one more that, I think you may have alluded to it, but, 1968 triple double, 53 points, 32 rebounds and 14 assists. That's the most points scored in a triple double game officially. And that of course was later in his career when he wasn't as much as focused on scoring. So that's another, you know, he could, obviously later in his career, he could still, put up, big point totals when called for.
I like the not worrying about it. Oh, I'll just drop 53. Yeah. I don't really want to score, but I guess I'll drop 53.
Why not? You know,
I mean, if you guys aren't going to do it, I'll just.
If only Kobe could do that today.
Right. He tries.
Yeah, that's true. He does.
Not for lack of effort. Yeah, I'll tell you.
Not like a shot. That's for sure. So, so I guess we'll move on to single season stats and Dan, we'll let you go first. Is there anything that really stands out to you in terms of accomplishments that he had in the season?
Well, I posted this on the Twitter account recently. I didn't know until I actually tallied it up myself, but he averaged a triple-double for the entire second half of the 1968 season. So I think the numbers were 25.3 points per game, and he shot 62% from the field doing that, 23 rebounds a game, and 10.6 assists per game. That's the 41 games of the second half of that season. So he was really on fire, you know, in the second half of that season.
Yeah. Now, was that the season where he was trying to lead the league in assists?
That would be that season, yes.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So, that, I mean, that's interesting, you know, and that goes to kind of a little bit of his mentality and a little bit of his motivation. I mean, it must be hard. We've seen that with other dominant players where it's hard for them. They have to find a new challenge to keep motivated because kind of like the routine things, the things are, you know, a little bit easy for them, you know, easy maybe isn't quite the right word, but you know what I'm saying. I think.
Right, right. It's not enough just to win the game. You have to win the game and also break a record or something.
Sure.
I think for me, one of the things, we've talked about it a little bit, I believe, on this podcast, and I know there's been articles written about it, about Wilt's rebounding and just how insane it was, and how you can almost even make a case. I mean, everybody knows him for the 100-point game and the tremendous scoring, but you can make a case rebounding-wise. He's the greatest rebounder of all time, and it might even be more impressive of a rebounder than he is a scorer. And he's the only player with more than 2,000 rebounds in a season. He has 7 of the top rebounding seasons of all time. We'll get to a little bit of where he was when he retired in terms of all-time rebounds here in a little bit. But you just look at his rebounding numbers, and they're, you know, obviously the scoring just jumps out at you right away because that's, you know, the more flashy, the more dynamic, the sexier thing or whatever. But, man, those rebounding numbers are so gaudy when you look at them every single year. And just when you take in the total season numbers, it's just it's incredible.
Yeah, and that's yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing that maybe is the least appreciated by him. I think people might assume that Russell was a better rebounder, or at least a more productive rebounder, let's say. But yeah, but Chamberlain beat him almost every season, if not every. Yeah, I think Russell may have beat him a couple times, but yeah, I mean, he has by far the record for the most rebounds in the season, you know, and with the scoring too. I mean, that's obviously what he's best known for. But he has the most points per game, 50.4, 1962. He also is second with 44.8, third, fourth, and sixth most. Jordan has the fifth most. In the same season that Wilt had 50. Elgin Baylor did have 38, but he only played, I think, 48 games that season because of military service. So it doesn't count officially in the record books, you know, as a season leader because he doesn't have enough games to qualify. But that's a slight caveat, but still, you know, amazing. You just, again, no one has come close to that, and I'm not guessing that anyone's ever going to come close to that. Dan, is there anything else that any other ones that stand out to you?
Are we still talking about season records, or
Or if you want to move on to a different category, we're loose and free here.
Well, I just feel like pointing out with Basketball Reference, since you guys like to use it, there's a way you can look at the top 10 leaders of statistics such as scoring. Mm-hmm. And if you guys have ever looked at the top 10 scorers, points per game throughout history, if you subtracted Wilt from that, because, you know, like you guys mentioned pace before, there's more, the teams are taking more shots, so there's more rebounds, for example, available. But I don't think a lot of people realize when they start going into that the scoring leaders throughout the history of the game, it's been pretty consistent minus Wilt Chamberlain. For example, that 62 season, although Elgin is officially not the leader, the next best would be Walt Bellamy, and he averaged 31.5 points per game that season, which is, I think Kevin Durant did that just a few seasons ago. And that's the 1962 season where Wilt averaged 50. So him and the next closest are, even in his own time, very far apart.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I mean, that really is a I mean, you know, even if you consider that adjustment for pace, it's still no one came close to that then, and obviously no one even if you were going to try to consider pace, there's no one in history, not even Jordan, who would come close to the per possession scoring that Wilt had that year. Yeah, the other thing I think is that's impressive. I mean, there are many things, but one thing that stands out to me is also is he has the highest field goal percentage in a season in the 73 season, which was his last year. He had 72.7%, made 426 out of 586 shots. But I think even more impressive than that is that he has the 68.3 in 1967, the year that they won the 76ers won the championship, in almost double the shots he had, 68.3% shooting. I mean, that's just, that's just unheard of. And that was obviously, intentional thing for him later in his career to be more efficient, understanding the value of that.
Right. I have in that 67 season, I have a 20-game stretch. He averaged 27 points on 76% from the field for a 26 for a 20-game stretch.
Yeah.
So he's making more than three quarters of all the shots that he's attempting at a rate of 27 points a game. And he's also averaging 7.5 assists while he's doing that.
You know, one thing go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, somebody might at a glance look at his numbers, you know, how they dropped off when he stopped scoring so much. But he's still very much dominating the game on the offensive end when he's only scoring 24 or 25 points a game, at that time.
You know, one thing that I watched, recent video on your channel, and I think most people would kind of assume that Wilt largely, because he was so big and so overpowering, that he largely did his work around the basket, and he certainly probably did. But I mean, he really did. He also had a very good jump shot. He was, he was very comfortable at scoring from, a little bit of range and not just completely like around the basket.
Right, right. He had three primary shots, and it just depended on what the defense gave him. If there was a clear pass to the basket, he'd obviously go and try to dunk it, but nobody wants to give him a clear pass to the basket, obviously. So he had a finger roll shot, and he also had a fallaway shot if they overplayed him for that shot. So, and it was obviously effective. He was still taking that shot. I mean, I have footage of him taking that shot in the 1973 season and in the 1967 season where he was shooting, almost 70% or more than 70% from the field. So he didn't really even stop taking those shots when he was averaging that kind of accuracy. I think he probably was more careful with when he took them, but, that he wasn't playing like DeAndre Jordan and catching backdoor plays or just, doing putbacks with that kind of accuracy. He was also taking fadeaways. So I think that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. Moving on to some of his career stats, Rich, is there anything that stands out to you?
I think one of the fun ones, and I think a few people on Twitter mentioned it to us as well, is that the man never fouled out of a game, despite being a big man, despite, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, is a guy who got a lot of blocks, was a very good defender, never fouled out of a game. And in fact, he only averaged 2 fouls per game, or essentially 1 per every 23 minutes. So that's really impressive for a guy, a big man like that, a big man who's not shying away from contact, not shying away from getting blocks, not shying away from just being a decent defender, to never foul out of a game is just unbelievably impressive and just almost like hard to believe. It seems almost impossible, but it's true.
Actually, since you just mentioned that, I have an Excel sheet of his complete career and statistics, and I just counted the number of games he played that he had 5 fouls in. He played 1,305 games if you combine his playoffs and regular season. He only got to 5 fouls 30 times.
That's insane. Yeah, and that's where you get even more. I mean, I almost think of that being more impressive because you sort of think of, okay, you get to 5 and then you become really, sort of careful and you get away from
it. Right.
But the fact that he was never even, 30 out of what was the total? 1,045. Yeah, I mean, that's incredible. That's just an insanely low number of times to even get to 5. Because I think fouling out, avoiding fouling out is impressive and super impressive. But yeah, I think that 5, I'm glad you had that number because that I think is even more crazy. Jason, are you still there? I think we lost it.
No, I'm here. Sorry, my
went off. Oh, sorry.
I must have muted it. Yeah, Rich, you know, you talked about the, you know, with the rebounding, you know, one is that he retired with 22.9 rebounds per game. No NBA player has averaged more than 18.7 for a season. Now, you know, again, pace has a lot to do with that, but that's still, you know, if you consider his career number is greater than any NBA player has had, you know, volume wise for a season, that still stands out to me as something that, you know, goes up. And, you know, we don't have the rebound percentage stats for most of Wilt's career. That they're available, you know, later in his career. But even those seasons would rank, you know, in the top 50 all time in seasons for rebound percentage. So, you know, if you're kind of considering what he did in the prime of his career, I think it's pretty likely that he's near the top, if not at the top, when it comes to rebound percentage. I mean, maybe behind somebody like Rodman or Moses Malone, but, you know, but he's going to be certainly up there, and probably has multiple seasons that are, you know, high up on that list. Dan, do you have anything career stats wise?
He has a record that I don't think will probably be broken in most consecutive field goals made without a miss, and that's 35. And he did that spanning a four-game stretch where he just didn't miss from the field.
Yeah, that's that. I'm going to go ahead and guess that one was going to be, you know, even if Steph Curry gets really hot, that's probably not, he's probably not going to make 35 straight. Yeah.
The only guy that would be able to do that is like some scrub that maybe comes into the fourth quarter or whatever and just takes a shot super close to the rim. But, it wouldn't be in that volume. It might take them like a year to do that. You know what I mean? Like you get somebody like a Steve Novak or not even him because he's taking threes. I'm trying to think of like a big, tall scrub dude that just like gets in and then like, you know, in 10 seconds,
like Jeff Withy or something, you know?
Yeah. Someone like that. I probably would be able to do it and nobody would care because it would take them like 2 years to do it. But yeah, in terms of like doing it in four games. Yeah. That's just
probably not going to happen. No,
no.
When Wilt did that, he also set the record for most, in a game without a miss. It was in the middle of that 35, shot stretch, but one of those games he shot 18 for 18.
So, Jeff Withey would not do that. I will go on record as saying I don't believe Jeff Withey will do that.
Yeah,
we'll see.
Do we have any idea who has the most consecutive shots made other than Wilt? I didn't think to look that up.
I don't know who has it other than him, but I know he has the next two times. He also made 32 in a row twice on top of the 35 in a row.
Wow.
On two different occasions, two different seasons. He did it in 1964, and he did it earlier in that 1967 season where he had made 32 in a row.
Yeah. You know, one for me is that Wilt, another rebounding one, is that he has 23,924 rebounds. He has more than 2,000 more than Russell. And he has more than 9,000 more than Tim Duncan and Kevin Garnett, who are the number one and two active leaders in rebounding. So yeah, basically they have less than two thirds of his rebounds. So less. Yeah. Not nearly as many is the point there. And yeah, that one just stands out. Again, the volume of rebounding is just, it kind of boggles the mind. It's almost hard to imagine the game, you know, and watched, you know, a decent amount of it, but it's still kind of just hard to like, we're just used to the way the game is played now. And it's just hard to kind of harken back to that a little bit.
Yeah. That's probably the biggest difference in the game then to now is just the amount of available rebounds. So I don't think any of those records, those rebounding records are likely to be, likely to be approached. So
for sure. Rich, is there any are there any other career ones or any others that stand out to you?
Yeah, I think there's definitely consecutive games with 50 points or more. He has 7 in a row in terms of streaks, if we're kind of moving on to that a little bit. In terms of other stuff, 14 straight 40-point or more games.
Yeah. Which is and those are both in 61-62 season.
Yeah, which is just an unbelievable year. Yeah. We're going to talk about that one a little bit here. That's like the break the entire game sort of year in a lot of ways. But just, you know, 7 straight of 50 is just impressive. And then, you know, 14 straight of 40 is just, it's out of this world. And that's, you know, that's a good chunk of the season right there that he was guaranteed either 50 or 40, which is just crazy.
Yeah. He also reached 20,000 points in 499 games, and Jordan did that in more than 620 games. He also has the record for consecutive triple-doubles and triple-doubles with 9 and double-doubles with 227. He had 227 consecutive double-doubles, which that's, yeah.
You probably don't have that handy, or maybe you do. In terms of what was his stat line on the game when he didn't get a double double of that, Dan? Do you know that? Because I'm sure it was like 29 and like 9 or something. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Like 38-9 or something like that. Or,
you know, I don't have that one in front of me, but that might be one that I'll have to tweet or something.
Yeah, I promise
look
it's
that
like
up. When he finally broke it. You know, was it? Yeah,
you know
like
he has 9 rebounds too.
Right,
yeah, you
right.
know he's just got right. 9. Yeah, you know yeah. he's got like 48-9
or maybe,
something like that.
Or
like
maybe he was injured or something, right? And
yeah.
maybe he just got pulled from the game from injury. I'm
That's
not
true,
sure.
Yeah,
or maybe it was just a road statistician who didn't, you know, want to give him the 10th rebound or something. I think we're basically through most of the stats of interest. Dan, is there anything else that stands out to you?
No, I'll just let you lead the conversation to whatever the next point is you
okay,
wanted
sure.
to make.
Well, he broke the points record in 1966. He passed Bob Pettit with 20,801. It was the year after Pettit had retired, and it was in the middle of Wilt's 7th season in the league when he broke the points record. I mean, that's just like,
wow.
And Pettit had played for 12-13 years, I think, when that had happened. So basically almost half of Pettit's career. I mean, he just completely blew that away. And Rich, you compiled where Wilt ranked upon retirement in some of the major categories. So I'm interested in that.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are staggering. In terms of the stuff that he, what he retired as, you know, being number one, and then also how far ahead he was of the people he beat out. So minutes played, he was first place, of course, when he retired. The next closest guy was Oscar Robertson, and that was 6,450 minutes behind Wilt at that point. And what I basically did is I wanted to also check out the career output of, like, other players and how that sort of ranks in terms of, like, what we can say is that basically Wilt was a Brian Cardinal better than Oscar Robertson in minutes played, so I found that kind of funny. This one especially will get people to laugh probably a little bit. Field goals, he, of course, was first. He beat out Oscar Robertson yet again by 3,511, which is basically the career output of guys like Gerald Wallace, Steve Francis, or George Mikan. So he's a George Mikan better than Oscar Robertson in terms of field goals.
Yes.
Field goals attempted. Elgin Baylor was the next closest. That was 326. And that's the career output of guys like C.J. Watson, Nikola Vucevic, and then Derek Favors as well. So just an insane amount ahead of some guys. Effective field goal percentage, he was second, unfortunately. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar at 55.6 was just ahead of him. But, of course, that's not really a cumulative number. And at that point, you know, of course, Kareem was still...
Yeah, 4 years in the league or so.
Yeah, exactly. Relatively new in the league. But Wilt wasn't far behind. Kareem had 55.6 effective field goal. Wilt had 54%, so not bad. Free throw attempts, Wilt was first. The next closest, again, was Oscar Robertson at 2,931, and that's about the career output of Bill Laimbeer. So he was a Bill Laimbeer ahead of Oscar Robertson in free throw attempts.
Yeah. Bill Laimbeer is the guy who played like 12, 13 years.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, he had a long career, yeah.
I mean, that's an entire, yeah, it's crazy. And a guy who, not really like a point guard, you know,
yeah, I mean,
Bill Laimbeer,
fouls,
I believe.
Yeah.
Exactly, a guy who I think was, you know, in the lane or could have had arms, you know, reaching it at points, but still, you know, Wilt was a whole... Bill Laimbeer ahead of Oscar Robertson. Total rebounds, of course, he was first ahead of Bill Russell by 2,301, which is basically the career output of Ricky Pierce, who played for, I think, what, 13 years?
Something like that, yeah.
Or so, yeah. So, of course, Ricky Pierce, not like the primitive, like, big man of his era or whatever, but still, it's a lot of years to be completely ahead. I mean, and that's of Bill Russell, too. It's not like some random no-name guy that he was ahead of rebound. That was Bill Russell. So that going to your point a little bit where you were talking about people maybe thinking that Bill Russell was a better rebounder. I mean, that's a tough case to make. I think my favorite one of these all, assists, he was sixth when he retired all-time. And the guys ahead of him are just like a who's who in terms of guys. Oscar Robertson, Bob Cousy, Guy Rogers, Lenny Wilkins, and Jerry West. So I thought that was a fascinating list of guys. And then points, he was first. The next closest, unfortunately, again, Oscar Robertson at 5,597 points behind Wilt. And that's basically the career output of guys like Hubert Davis and Sam Bowie. So Hubert Davis, I believe, also played like 13 or 14 years in the league. So it's just insane of like the space between Wilt and some of these guys in terms of when he retired. And where it was, and really, you look at a lot of these. Some of these are still as impressive, and we've mentioned them throughout time, including you know different stats. It's insane how when he retired, and still how much of the records he still in some ways still has and still dominates the leaderboards.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's I think that the assist one is really interesting. I mean, the fact like five of the greatest point guards in the game's history at that time. And then Will Chamberlain.
And then Will Chamberlain. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, I don't even know what to do with that one. I mean, that's just, I don't know. What do you think of that one, Dan? Which, are there any of these that impress you the most?
Well, I think, like you guys are pointing out, the assist ones, I think it's one that doesn't get a lot of attention because his scoring is so outrageous early in his career that in the middle of his career, and even towards the end of his career, he was either among the league leaders in assists for a season, or he was leading the league's centers in assists for basically all the years that he wasn't the scoring leader. And even some of the years that he was among the top ranked scorers. So he maybe could be argued as one of the greatest passing centers of all time based on his assists. Although, I've yet to put together a video where we can really highlight that, but I'd like to do that at some point because his assist numbers are so outrageous.
Yeah. And we're going to kind of go a little bit more in depth in the 61-62 season, which is his most famous season, the year he scored 100 points in a game and had more than 50 points average for the season. But first, I wanted to kind of get into something that I think has been brought up at times, a little bit of a criticism of Wilt's numbers is the fact that the quality of opposition. And obviously, it's a different era. There are, he is, even bigger and stronger in scale than he would be today. Although I still think he would be a very physically dominating player if he played today. Like, I don't think there's any question about that. He definitely was facing a weaker quality of competition in part because, there were fewer talented big men and there was still a system of discrimination that favored white players. There were still, I looked this up and there were 31 other centers who played more than 300 games during Wilt's career. 17 of them were 6'10 or taller, and 20 of them were 225 pounds or more. Wilt was listed at, I believe, 7'3", 275. He competed against Hall of Famers and All-Stars like Bill Russell, Walt Bellamy, Kareem, Willis Reed, Nate Thurmond, Wayne Embry, Red Kerr, Zelma Beatty. A lot of his career, he's playing in a league that is 8 or 9 team league. So he's, playing these guys 12 or so times a year, up until 67, 68 when expansion kind of really hits home. So, I'm not going to say that, he didn't benefit from some things in his era that happened, but I don't, like, he wasn't facing scrubs every night or anything like that. I mean, he was facing up against big, strong guys in a tough league, very physical league, and playing against some, big, strong guys in some elite players.
If I could touch on that, first off, he was listed 7'1", 275, okay. But I'll just point out that he was listed 7'1", but if you look at, for example, a player today like Spencer Hawes, who is listed at 7'1", Wilt was actually 7'1", and that was a barefoot measurement. with players that might also get listed 7'1", like Spencer Hawes today. He was listed, or he was measured at 6'10½". So a lot of people don't realize this is why he looks so much bigger than a lot of other players. He was, I guess you could say, unfilled. And his weight was closer to 290 to 310 pounds through much of his career. Mm-hmm. That goes for a lot of his competition as well. Like Bill Russell for a while was listed at 6'9", I think, but he was about 6'10" without shoes, which if you compare with players today or many of the other players, that would give him about a 6'11", you know, listed height. So he was playing against guys that were of I guess you could say an expected size at the center position in his own era. They're not always listed the same way that players get listed today. They're underbilled a little bit. I'm not sure why. Maybe for as the NBA has gotten more popular, they want to really, you know, build these guys up, or maybe the shoes got bigger. I'm not sure, but yeah,
maybe
he's definitely
more of a consistent approach, or you know, yeah.
I'd say a little bit of both of what you mentioned. We know famously, you know, the Tim Duncan one of like, you know, we needed the 7 foot twin towers. So we'll round up a little bit.
Yeah. And Kevin
right,
Garnett.
Right.
Yeah, and some guys like don't like, they want to be 6'11" instead of 7 foot, you know, like Kevin Garnett, I think is famous for that, but.
Exactly. So, but he, if you saw him, yeah, he would look like he would be like a 7'3" guy, just based on how they list players today. He would be a very imposing player. I think he had a 7'8" arm span. There's like a video where he's getting his arm span measured with Muhammad Ali. And the numbers, if you put him through like a draft thing where they're, you know, a scout is trying to draft a player, his physical proportions would probably blow them away because they're bigger than Shaq. So,
yeah, and I think that was a good point. Jason brought that up, and you brought it up a little bit as well, Dan. It's just that the physical, we sort of assume that he was, you know, playing against guys that were 5'5". You know, we hear people say, oh, they were just, you know, 5'5" white guys, and there was Wilt Chamberlain or whatever. You know, it's like, that's not, I mean, the guy, even in his era, like you said, there were guys that were big. But him as well, you look at that guy, and that's my bigger point here of, this is a guy who, you know, physically, you're right in, on the money that this guy could come in today's NBA and still be, you know,
I mean, he'd be the best athlete today, or, you know,
that's
or
what I mean, like,
top
like,
three or four, you know.
Yeah, and, like, that's even without, like, that's ignoring, like, that he has modern you know, modern nutrition, that sort of stuff. I think even today that's a guy who, you know, just by his height and by his weight and his wingspan could be just as well. And then you add in the factor of, hey, well, these guys have better shoes and better workout facilities and better nutrition and that sort of stuff. And you look at a guy and it's like, yeah, it's no doubt that Wilt Chamberlain could translate, not only if you just plopped whatever, you know, 1962 Wilt Chamberlain in today's game. No, he's not scoring 100, but I think he does pretty well. But then if you add in Wilt Chamberlain and then give him all the modern amenities that we have now, there's no doubt in my mind that would still be a guy that, I mean, he's, of course, again, not scoring 100 points a game, but nobody that he's not a guy that just was of his era, and like any other era, he'd be completely lost and have no idea what he's doing and anything like that. It's just not true.
Yeah, and look at film of him running and jumping, and ask yourself how many guys who are 7'3" look like they can move around on the floor like that, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So getting a little deeper into the 61-62 season, just a few tidbits from that. And I want to talk about, we mentioned this a little bit, the context of pace, which is important. You know, in the early 60s, you know, the pace was obviously was incredibly increased after the arrival of the shot clock and changes in fouling rules led to a faster game. The Celtics dynasty helped popularize that with the fast breaking. And by 62, there was an estimated 125.5 possessions per 48 minutes, which is basketball reference versus if you're looking at the 2015-2016 season, it's about 90 possessions per 48 minutes, which is actually faster than it's been. It's been getting faster in recent years. It was, I think, in the 80s, the high 80s at one point. This is per the ESPN John Hollinger stats. This is obviously important context. We've talked about that. But I think it should be pointed out that, like, playing faster is more grueling to endure. Like, I think it should be – I think the fact that you – play more possessions in 48 minutes, I think that is still a more impressive feat to accumulate those statistics, because you're doing it when you're tired and everyone else is tired too, especially when you're playing, you know, 45.3 minutes per game. I mean, I'm sure there's times where you take it a little bit easier on defense, or, you know, it's a different game, so it's understandable. I'm sure you're not going out, you know, every single thing. I mean, you can't do that today either, but I still think that I don't think it should just be dismissed because, oh, they played faster, so they have better numbers. Like, I think the other things are important too.
Yeah, and they share the ball more, it seems to be, because if you look at, like I said, the ceiling for scores when the pace was faster, most of the players are still not averaging, you know, more than 32 points a game, or, you know, they'll be the top 10 scorers, they're scoring between 25 and 30 points a game, even in that era, even with all the increased possessions for a team. Their teammates are also scoring higher, so like the role players are getting 15 points a game and 20 points a game, which is what we don't see as much of today, but that the dominant scorers on the teams are not averaging 50, other than Will. It's so he's kind of an outlier there, and it's hard to even quantify his scoring, even in that era, because nobody else was doing that. So, you know, there's still like a 20-point gap between him and the next best scorer, Walt Bellamy, for 1962.
So I think we mentioned this, but just for emphasis, 63 40-point games that season. He scored 50 or more points 45 times. It was an 80-game season, and he scored 60 or more in 14 games. And you, Rich, you compiled where, like, how far ahead he was on the leaderboard in some of the top statistics.
Yeah, again, just staggering numbers of a lot of stuff. Minutes played, he led by 379 minutes over Oscar Robertson, which is going to be the lesser of the probably all the numbers that we come up with. Field goals attempted, he led Bod Pettit by 1,231, so not bad, including this little caveat that Bod Pettit had 1,928 that year as well. So essentially lapped Bod Pettit in terms of field goals attempted, which is just incredible stuff. Free throws attempted, he led Jerry West by 437. Total rebounds led Bill Russell by 262, rather. And then points, Dan alluded to it here a little bit, he led Walt Bellamy by 1,534. So, and Walt Bellamy had 2,495 that year as well. So not quite lap, but pretty much, you know, just insane level of output over his peers and his opponents at that time. Just incredible.
Yeah. And, you know, that was also Oscar Robertson's triple-double season. And, you know, Will initially set the a points record, breaking Elgin Baylor's record in a game against the Lakers, where he had 78 points on 62 shots and 43 rebounds. Baylor, meanwhile, in that same game, had 63 points on 55 shots. And then he broke his own single-season scoring record on February 8th, 62, which the season ended March 14th. So more than a month before the season ended, he had already broken his own single season scoring record. On February 22nd of that year, he had a 65th straight game with 30 or more. And then finally in March 2nd, 1962, 100 points, 25 rebounds. It was 36 of 63 shooting, 28 of 32 free throws. He made his free throws that night. And he set in that game, set NBA records for points, field goals made, field goals attempted, free throws made, and free throws attempted. I think those are all still records. I'm not 100% sure about the free throws, but I think everything else is pretty safe definitely still being a record. So, Dan, anything else about that season or the 100-point game or anything that really stands out to you?
Yeah, he played 63 minutes in that game that you mentioned, where he had 78 points and 43 rebounds. I'm not sure if the 63 minutes is an NBA record, but I can't see any other games where he played more minutes than that in a single game, and I'm not sure any other player would have played 63 minutes in a game either. So that might be a record right there as well.
Yeah, and that obviously helped him. I don't think we mentioned, famously, he averaged more than 48 minutes a game in that season because, you know, that's, I'm sure the 63-1 helped, but he played almost every minute of every game. You know, he sat out for a few minutes here and there, but with the overtimes and such, he actually averaged more than 48 minutes per game. So just incredible. So, Dan, before we go, is there anything else you want to mention, or you want to let everyone know where they can find you on Twitter and on your YouTube account?
I guess there's nothing I have in closing. Just I think my Twitter handle is Wilt C Archive, and I think you can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/WiltChamberlainArchive. And, you know, I don't just do videos on Wilt Chamberlain. I try to cover the entire, you know, era that he played in and try to give a lot of players that don't get a lot of attention or highlights. I try to put up as much video content as I can to sort of, you know, give everyone their due from that time period. So,
yeah. And you've got some great, it's organized really well with some great playlists and, you know, there's long videos and short videos. I mean, there's a whole plethora of stuff. So, you know, whether you have a lot of time to delve into it or just, you know, a few minutes to just check out highlights of a player here, it's a really great way to explore NBA history. It's a really great tool. We really, appreciate you doing it, and we appreciate you being on the show so much. This was really great.
All right. Thank you.
All right. And everyone, of course, can, check us out, at hardwoodparoxysm.com. We are part of the Hardwood Paroxysm network of podcasts. You can subscribe to both Over and Back and the HP network on iTunes. If you would leave us a rating and review, we would absolutely love you. We would praise your name to the heavens for your wonderful generosity in doing that. We have a forum at overandbacknba.com where you can discuss basketball history. And we're on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. Rich, did I forget anything?
No, Facebook. You said Facebook.
I said Facebook, yes. So,
okay, that was the only one I don't remember here.
All right,
yes,
there you go. Facebook and Twitter at Over and Back NBA. So,
you did mention how much we'd adore if people left us a review.
We would adore it, absolutely. So, you know, any feedback would be great. We really enjoy doing this. Hope we might delve into some other players in this format if people respond well to this. So, until next time, thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.